7:32. There's actually just a brief window of time if you want to climb Mount Everest from May to June. This season, over 800 people tried to climb the summit after a record number of permits were actually issued by the Nepalese government, but 11 died on the mountain this season. It's the fourth deadliest on record. And as I said before, we've seen other deaths as well in the Himalayas, more widely speaking. Filmmaker Alia Saikali, who recently reached the final stage before the summit, the Hillary Step on May 23rd, joins us on the line. Thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Can you start by telling us why you wanted to climb Everest? A lot of us just grow up with this idea, I guess, that it's just one of those major milestones that very few manage to conquer. Was that part of it for you?
That actually had nothing to do with, you know, my reasons for wanting to climb Everest. You know, I come at it from a bit of a different angle as a storyteller and as a filmmaker. And my initial expedition to Everest back in 2005 had everything to do with honoring the life of a friend of mine who unfortunately passed away in the Himalayas on his way to the top of the world. So I returned to the mountain, climbed in his honor, and I told that story and I made that film. So for me, it's, you know, I always say I'm chasing the stories, not the summits. And a lot of the stories that I like to tell happen to take place on the world's tallest mountains. So that's why I was there in this case this year.
It's a particularly poignant reason, but of course you have to have some capability, don't you? I mean, what do you make of this trend of people who do want to just climb a mountain, which may be an honourable goal in itself, but if they're not quite equipped for it physically or in terms of experience?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I always say, you know, who are we to judge each other's dreams, right? So if somebody has the ambition to, you know, test themselves and to stand on top of the world, and they have that lofty goal of getting up there at 29,000, 35 feet. You know, who are we to judge? You know, but I think, you know, more importantly, it's you know, how prepared are you when you show up? You know, and have you done your homework, and have you hired a responsible company, and have you made responsible decisions about, you know, ensuring that your own life is secure, and also, you know, as importantly, you know, the lives of the people around you. So, you know, this year what we saw were a number of climbers who were ill-prepared. I think this is common practice, unfortunately, on the world's tallest mountain. And what you see as well, you know, beyond the lineups, which was part of the sensation, of course, you know, the quote-unquote traffic jams that we saw, which were very real, what we saw were individuals that were unwilling to turn back, unwilling to listen to their bodies, listen to their Sherpa guides and comrades who were, you know, possibly advising them, you know, to turn back. Because, you know, once you sort of touch that edge and you find that edge, once you step over, there's just no coming back.
This idea of it being so overcrowded and potentially dangerous, is that very pronounced this time compared with your previous trips to Everest and your previous mountain climbing experiences?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, it was shocking to see the lineups this year with my own eyes. I had seen the images over the course of the last couple of years. I had decided that I was done with Everest after 2014 and 2015. Those are the two deadliest years on record, where almost 50 people died during you know, two deadly avalanches. But being up there this year and seeing it with my own eyes, it was quite alarming. I was very worried, you know, for our own safety, for the safety of everybody on that mountain that evening. And, you know, it's worth noting as well that, you know, even though there were 200 plus climbers that were climbing to the summit on the night of May 22nd, we summited the morning of the 23rd, our team was able to navigate the traffic. And, you know, I was with a team of four Arab women from the Middle East, North Africa region, and I was making a film called The Dream of Everest. And our team was very well prepared. We had outstanding Sherpa support. We had ample oxygen. We had hired a very responsible company, and we were able to navigate the lines past, you know, between 40 and 60 climbers, make our way to the summit and descend without incident. So, you know, the question I ask people is, well, you know, if the traffic was the sole problem, then, you know, how were we able to navigate that situation? And we were able to navigate it because of experience.
So, as you say, choosing a responsible company is a very important step. Does the Nepalese government have to do more, though, to try to ensure safety?
Absolutely. I think it would be wonderful if Nepalese stepped up and followed suit, and the Chinese, for example, who limited the number of permits this year. The trouble is that, you know, if you watch the trends, and, you know, I've been traveling to Everest since 2005, and, you know, often there's some controversy or there's some sensation, and unfortunately there's some loss of life year after year, and, you know, the mountain gets a lot of attention, you know, fingers are pointed, people are blamed. The government oftentimes will, you know, enforce, you know, new rules and impose these new rules, but it's a question of, are these rules being upheld? So, you know, that's the biggest issue that we see, and time after time, new rules come out, and they're not enforced. So hopefully the Nepalese government will take a good hard look at this and ideally follow suit of the Chinese government, who have enforced a limited number of permits, and follow in their footsteps.
And we see some of this through the tragic case of an experienced British climber who is among the latest people to die on Mount Everest this season, 44-year-old Robin Haynes Fisher, who'd actually, in his last social media post, described how he'd had to change his climbing plans in order to avoid crowds. He was on his descent from the summit, but he did pass away in what's rather, I suppose, poignantly called the death zone. It's an area named for the low levels of oxygen on descent from the summit. And that in itself tells us a story, regardless of crowding. We can't exactly sanitize the Everest experience, can we?
No, but what you can do is you can prepare for it. You know, the 8,000-meter environment known as the death zone, you know, people have climbed into the death zone, you know, for decades. I think it's a question of, you know, really listening to your body and knowing when to quit and having the humility to turn back if need be. You know, I've turned back twice 500 feet from the top of the world because of changing weather patterns. And, you know, you bow down with respect in the face of the mountain that really doesn't care at the end of the day who summits and who doesn't. And like I said, you know, I think a lot of people get into trouble because they're not listening to their bodies. They're going beyond the limit. You know, I have a hard time understanding how somebody gets frostbite up at 8,000 meters, because if you have an issue with your hands or your toes, you know, in your right frame of mind, you stop, you address the issue, and if there's a, you know, problem that can't be navigated, you turn around and you quit. You know, the mountain will always be there. So that perspective is lacking. That humility is lacking. Unfortunately, there's an obsession of reaching the summit. They call it summit fever, you know, and it's understandable to a degree. You know, you've trained for over a year. Sometimes you've mortgaged your life. You've put everything on the line, and there you are in the face of your dream. You can almost touch the sky, and you just, you know, you get summit fever, and you refuse to turn around. So I think, you know, listening to the local guides, hiring the responsible, ethical, you know, local operators, companies, and then just being honest with yourself about where your limit is and having the humility to turn back.
Right. Can you just describe to us a little bit further what it's actually like? For many of us listening now, we'll never attempt to climb anything like Everest. Maybe the extent of our mountain experience will be hiking. For example, here in Korea, where hiking is extremely popular. But altitude sickness, temperature changes, other weather disruptions, and potential safety issues due to overcrowding. Even when you're taking all the precautions, how does it really feel to climb Everest?
Yes, you know, it's a great question. And, you know, I caught myself saying this year to our lead guide, Garrett Madison, who owns the company Madison Mountaineering, I said, you know, you never feel quite right on Everest. You know, your mind isn't quite right. And certainly when you step into the death zone, you know, this is the area where your body literally starts to die, you know, and you're breathing supplemental oxygen through a mask that you've been carrying on your back for the past, you know, 48 hours. And your mind isn't quite working the way it normally does. The blood is not circulating. You know, your body is protecting the vital organs and doesn't really care about the extremities. And it's very difficult to think. It's very difficult to place one foot in front of the other. It's five breaths for every step that you take. And then imagine introducing complexities into that situation where you need to, you know, make decisions that will potentially, you know, save your life. So life becomes very complicated, and it's incredibly important to think through all of the scenarios, to have backup plan upon backup plan and contingency plans. And that's where, you know, having that support really ensures that you're as safe as possible, that your team members are as safe as possible. And at the end of the day, of course, that, you know, the local people are as safe as possible, the Sherpas who make all of this possible, because without them, nobody would be summiting Everest. It just wouldn't be possible.
Yeah, and for them as well, are they having to take financial risks? So money does seem to be an unfortunate connection in all of this. These licenses to climb Everest, they cost money, and obviously Sherpas are doing this as part of their livelihood.
It is part of their livelihood, and you know, you will oftentimes hear the Sherpas say that, you know, they climb so that their children don't have to follow in their footsteps. You know, it's one of the deadliest jobs on planet Earth. You know, you look at the Sherpas that, you know, set the lines and fix the ladders and find the route through the Khumbu Icefall, which is, you know, the most dangerous part of Everest. I mean, these men are putting their lives at risk, and you know, in some cases, they're compensated very well. You know, if you look at our team, we take incredibly good care of our Sherpas. We treat them incredibly fairly. They're well compensated. They're well equipped. You know, the really tragic part is when you look at the companies that are charging, you know, less than a premium, you know, say $30,000, $25,000 to climb Everest, when the going rate should be $60,000 to $65,000. You know, somebody is picking up the tab there, and unfortunately, it trickles down often to the local people and the Sherpa people who, you know, quite frankly, you know, this is their mountain and this is their country, and, you know, they have ownership over it as far as I'm concerned, and at times they're just not treated fairly and treated well, and they're putting their lives at risk. And so it's up to us to make those responsible decisions from the get-go and decide, you know, what kind of ethical outfitter am I going to hire to ensure my safety and the safety of everybody on the mountain, including the local people.
I'm sure you've inspired quite a few of us to look out for your film. Can you tell us a bit more about what it will show and what stage of production we're at and so on?
Yeah, no, thank you for asking. So the film is called The Dream of Everest, and it's the story of four women from the Arab world, from Saudi Arabia, Oman, and Lebanon. And it's their journey to stand on top of the world, to break stereotypes and to show the world, you know, that women are capable of achieving, you know, incredible things from the region. And it's currently now wrapped production on Mount Everest. And so our next phase is to head out to the Middle East to, you know, complete production and the backstories, enter post-production, and the film should be out this fall, thedreamofeverest.com.
We'll look forward to checking that out. I mean, it's a huge summit in its own right, isn't it? I presume for those women dealing with some of the cultural barriers that exist, there are certain countries where even being a woman driving is a feat. But did you sense that they were free on the mountain?
Yeah, absolutely they were free. And I have to say, you know, I was incredibly proud of just how powerful they were, you know, on the summit night. You know, they navigated the long queues and the traffic jams, and you know, they stepped off those safety lines and they passed, you know, between 40 and 60 people. So, you know, absolutely they were free, you know, very, very, very much liberated. And, you know, I think also, you know, part of the story of the film is to break some of those misconceptions. You know, not all countries obviously are the same. And,
no.
You know, this film will really dive into that, tackle that, and tell their own stories through their eyes. So really looking forward to sharing that with the world.
Yeah, some excellent points there. We've got to leave it. But thank you so much for joining us today. Alaia Saikali, filmmaker, and The Dream of Everest's coming out this fall.
Thanks for having me.
So the time is just turning 7:46.